He's formerly the CEO of SEDEX, the world's largest not-for-profit ethical sourcing program covering environment, human trafficking, and business and human rights. He's currently the COO of the Responsible Business Alliance, a leading US-based environmental and business and human rights non-profit-based organization in Washington in the USA. Jonathan comes from the world of technology, where awareness of the impact of goods and services being managed across the world led him to be an evangelist for simplifying and improving awareness of, in inverted commas, shipping air to Europe and how to reduce expenditure and carbon footprint for members and for clients alike. Based locally in St. Albans with three boys and a cat and a Hertfordshire lad all his life, Jonathan looks to the future in helping raise awareness and standards for environmental and human rights by doing no harm in everyday life. Being a professional referee for the RFU in rugby could help resolve any difficulties today. And the candidates should know that he's brought his red and yellow cards tonight just in case any discipline is needed. We do hope not. Your chair for this evening, Jonathan Chapman.
Amanda, thank you, and to all of you, well done. Thank you for making it tonight, and of course to our panel here. In a moment, I'll invite each candidate to introduce themselves for a maximum of 2 minutes. You've been warned, 2 minutes. The questions have all been submitted by the audience, although I'm going to start with one on my own, and they will be selected to represent the most popular topics, and those are really from you as local and independent individuals. So broad themes are really around the environment and sustainability, Kira Husting is about, and the questioner will have the option to read their own question, which is really refreshing for me. The candidates will have 1 minute, and that will be policed by the lovely Ed down here to make sure that you do stick to the minute, otherwise the cards which I have brought with me will be out. All of the candidates, with respect, are bringing themselves forward for public office, and that's no small feat. I would ask you therefore to treat them with that respect and listen without interruption, whether you agree or not. The whole point of this is to allow that debate to happen. And let's have a listen to what they have to say and try and understand what they have to offer. So no jeering, please, otherwise my cards will come out for you as well. Just to remind you, just on the social media side, I know Amanda just said it, but you would have forgotten already, hashtag EnviroHust19. So don't forget to use that. That's live now. And the organising groups will be posting some of the material that you see recorded at the back, as Amanda mentioned, on media throughout the event. So if you do have concerns, please make yourself aware to those at the back. So first question up is from me, and this is just to set the tone, if I may, team, is just to say in one word answer, how did you get here tonight? One word, and it starts with the left here.
Can't do it in one word. On my bicycle.
Thank you. Julian, well done.
On please. Foot.
Foot.
Sadly, I'm going to have two words because I was away for a slight work commitment up in Nottingham, so I got the train and then on foot.
One word.
Feet.
Thank you.
Rubber. Jules. Circular rubber.
Well, hopefully the introduction will come now, as I just wanted to make sure that they had the opportunity then to present themselves. So if I would, I'm going to start with Julian Daly, who's standing in for Anne Main, just to introduce himself and talk a little bit about the Conservative Party and their approach for this, and yourself.
Okay, thank you very much. Some of you will know I'm a local councillor. I've been asked to step in at very short notice by Anne, who's not well tonight. I'm a former leader of the council and I'm a current member of the council's Climate Crisis Response Working Group, which may come up later. Anne's been the MP for St Albans for some 14 years and has always, to my knowledge, taken a keen interest in, if I can put it this way, green issues. She set up the all-party parliamentary group on the prevention of plastic waste, which some of you may have picked up on. And she's also more recently, similarly, set up the all-party parliamentary group on sustainable clothing and textiles with the likes of Zach Goldsmith. The issue facing us in the general election, of course, is the Jeremy Corbyn very high expenditure budget. The Lib Dems claiming they can stop Brexit, which will be very difficult for them to do unless they get into alliance in some form with Jeremy Corbyn and also win the second referendum. Or from a party political point of view, continue with a Conservative government and its sizeable commitment and delivery of jobs for the people who live in this country. I've been very grateful to Anne for her support locally for the EnviroTech Enterprise Zone alongside Hemel by the M1. I've been very grateful to her at a personal level for the work she's done on the Microbeads campaign, and several people in the room I recognise will have a view on the noise from Luton Airport if I widen out the topics, and the St Albans Quieter Skies Group and Laddercam, and how they've campaigned to try and deal with that. From a selfish point of view, I look forward to hearing what your questions are and from learning both from the you folk in the audience and my colleagues this evening on the bench here.
Daisy Cooper, Liberal Democrats.
Thank you and good evening, everybody. This should be the climate crisis election, but it's not. It's a Brexit election. We have 10 years to stop irreversible damage to our planet. Just 10 years. That's why we need to stop Brexit and focus on tackling the climate emergency now. I'm really proud that the Liberal Democrats have set an ambitious goal of becoming net zero by 2045 at the latest, a target endorsed by Friends of the Earth and WWF. More importantly, I'm also proud that the Lib Dems have committed to strong interim targets so we can achieve steep reductions in emissions well before then. And given that we have just 10 years to stop irreversible damage to our planet, I'm proud that the Liberal Democrats have pledged that in the next 10 years, we will take emergency action. We will take emergency action to plant 60 million trees a year, to ensure that 80% of our electricity comes from renewables, and to ensure that every home in Britain is properly insulated, starting with those living in fuel poverty. Now, I'm a committed environmentalist. I always have been. Just this year, I have helped collect signatures for the climate emergency petition, which was passed by our council. I have protested with you to protect the River Ver from over-extraction and the change in the climate. I've led campaigns to improve public transport here in St Albans, and I'm currently campaigning against Luton Airport expansion. In St Albans, in this general election, there is a very clear choice. The choice is between me and the Liberal Democrats or the Conservatives. And I hope that by the end of this evening, you will decide to put your trust in me. I hope that next Thursday on the 12th of December, you choose to elect me as your Member of Parliament. Thank you.
Daisy, thank you. Rebecca Lurie from Labour.
So thank you very much for inviting me. I am currently deputy leader in Southwark, where we've declared a climate emergency, and we're taking steps now to consider all the environmental impact of every single one of our... But I'm also lucky enough to be the cabinet member who's responsible for tree management and protecting the 80,000 trees in our control. And that means the environment is very high on my priority list. Alongside this, I'm also the cabinet member who's responsible for parks, ensuring that they're well looked after and that we're promoting the importance. But we're not going far enough currently with our environmental policies, and it's only right that this has become such an important issue at this election. The Labour Party takes these issues so seriously, we've published three separate documents detailing our plans: a Green Industrial Revolution, our Green Transformation Fund, and our Plan for Nature. I'm sure we'll discuss many of those themes this evening, but to highlight some of our key commitments, those include a National Transformation Fund of £400 billion, with £250 billion going directly to the Green Transformation Fund, introducing zero carbon homes for all new homes, 7,000 offshore and 2,000 onshore wind turbines, £3 billion in the production of new electrical vehicles, with many more billion pounds committed to the rollout of the vehicle charging network and interest-free loans for electric vehicles, planting 2 billion trees by 2040, and looking at our food production and our food waste, ensuring that we have a right to food and a people's access to food fund. But those alone aren't the reasons to vote Labour at this election. At this election, you'll be voting Labour to put money back into the NHS, the local schools and the police, and you'll be voting to take urgent action on the environmental crisis facing our country and the world. Thank you.
Jules Sherrington, Independent.
Yes, it's a very, very heavy subject of climate change. I don't believe there's an instant fix to it, but it needs a collective effort, not just with everybody in this country, but other European countries and countries further afield. Some countries are still going through their industrial revolution that we went through 300 years ago, but we didn't have anybody knocking on our door to tell us, oh, we can't be puffing all this CO2 out and dirtying the buildings. But, however said that, there are means of actually capturing the carbon that is emitted and actually taking it and then burying it back into the ground, because that's where it's come from. Or it's one of the results of using fossil fuels, and that's one of the big problems. Something that I thought about in 1975, I'm an inventor, by the way, and I'm always looking for more efficient ways to produce something that's nothing to do with the cost of activity, but something that can be useful to the rest of the community that we're living, and maybe on a wider stand as well. I was thinking about the use of hydrogen, which we all know from school, that by electrolytical conversion, applying a power to an anode and a cathode, it produces, this is one of the little things we used to do in chemistry, is and then get a match and we'd light it, and it would ignite the hydrogen. The moment it's lit, it goes back to water. We have an abundance of water in this world, and we're not doing it. And we've been hamstrung over the years, probably the last 50 or 60 years, by the petrochemical...
Jules, you're coming up on time. Keep going, but okay, you're coming up right. on time.
The petrochemical companies have been lobbying, not just our government, but many governments around the world, to prevent the licensing of manufacture of hydrogen-burning internal combustion engines. And we need to be looking at this, because this will make a great difference to the health of us in England and in fact the rest of the world. Yes.
I'm going to lose the evening. Well done, Jules. That's your panel for this evening. Thank you very much. One more. So I'm going to miss Simon.
And Simon Grover, I mean, well, need to get all the questions. That's the trouble. Simon, forgive me.
That's all right, save the best till last. Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming out. Yes, I'm Simon. I'm an actor and writer and a local councillor in St Albans. I've lived here most of my life. I was born in St Albans. I've been a councillor since 2011, and I've been re-elected twice since then, in unlikely event that I'm not your MP on December the 13th. I also have provisional plans to stand again next year. So you'll have a chance to vote for me again then, some of you. One of the reasons I think that I've been re-elected is that I get a lot of stuff done at the council. I do, obviously, the normal things that all councillors do, so I help with missed bins and people who have homelessness issues, that sort of thing. But obviously my main focus has always been the environment. That's what I got into politics for. So I have done things like getting solar panels put on council buildings. I've got council buildings insulated. I helped to kickstart the electric taxi scheme in St Albans, and so on and so on. And now at the moment, I'm helping to put together the council strategy for dealing with the climate emergency. And we've committed, I'm very, very pleased to say that the council has committed to get St Albans down to zero carbon or net zero carbon by 2030 in just 10 years. So there's a lot of work to do there to put that strategy together. But of course, we need a national strategy as well, with the same target, net zero carbon by 2030. That's what we as a leading industrial nation have a moral duty to do, but also a practical duty to help the world to make this essential transition. And that's why I'm standing in this election, because I want to encourage people to vote green, because every green vote tells the message to the eventual parties who run the country, or the MPs, that people care about this issue. Every single green vote counts in that way, because we are the only party that has anything like the breadth of policy that is necessary to reach that target. We have a full programme, a fully costed programme as well, that will get us there.
Well done, the panel. So, keen to get moving forward. So, our first question this evening has come from Jane Watkinson. Jane, where are you? Mimi's going to find you with a microphone.
The experts who spoke at the end of Channel 4's climate debate said no party is pledging to do enough to tackle a climate crisis. What will you do to persuade party leaders or the new government to do more?
So, what would you do to persuade your own party to do more? And in strict order rotation, so I don't get it wrong, Julian.
Okay. I agree with the conclusion, actually, that the Channel 4 folk had. It is necessary to have a realistic view on what will deliver the solutions. Jules sort of touched on it, I guess, because I do think innovation, the history of this country of coming up with solutions to problems, needs to be teased out. With buried in the detail, certainly of our manifesto, but of others too, is a big commitment to R&D in this space. On our patch, we have the Building Research Establishment, who are global leaders in setting standards for many of the things that other parties are talking about. Whoever represents St Albans needs to make sure that that knowledge is shared with the rest of the world, as well as on our own patch. We also, just over the border, have Rothamsted, who do similar work for agricultural research. And again, they need to be championed. Right on our doorstep, we have many of the solutions.
Spot on time. Well done. Leading the field. Daisy.
I think you're right. No party has pledged to do enough, but some are pledging to do a lot more than others. One of the things that I found most shocking this year was that in July, the Committee on Climate Change did an analysis, a progress report on where the government was at, and they said it was a brutal reality check. They said that the Conservative government had only delivered one of 25 critical policies, that with less than 10 years to go, the climate emergency was being treated like a Dad's Army operation, and that we as a country are losing credibility as the host of a UN summit next year on climate change. That really, really worries me. So yes, I would do more to persuade the Liberal Democrats to do more in government, but also a key pillar of our plan for tackling the climate emergency is devolving powers and budgets and fundraising powers to local councils so that local councils can take the lead. We've seen already that the Liberal Democrat-run council has declared a climate emergency. It was the very first thing they did. And there is a huge appetite in St Albans for more action. So rather than just asking the government what they can do, we need local authorities to take the lead.
Thank you. Well, keeping to time, Rebecca, try and keep the same.
Of course, thank you very much for that. And thank you for the question, and I think you're completely right. But I think that things like the mass school campaigns that have been going on have really made this issue such an important issue for this election. I want to commend all the people that have taken part in those. But what's not good enough is us all just passing motions and talking about the great things and the great signals we're making about how we're going to do something about the climate. And we need to actually take action and do something about it. I completely agree with Daisy, actually, when she says that local government is one of the places that we can be doing this. There are already so many councils doing brilliant work on this issue, and we need to make sure that they are receiving the money that means they can continue to do that work. But it's also about supporting those ongoing campaigns and the school strikes that are going on and all the Extinction Rebellion protests that are happening to really show that this issue isn't going away. But I would also commit to working with other parties. I don't think we can sit here and say we've got every single thing right in our manifesto, and there are a number of things that all parties are saying that we should be bringing together if we're serious about tackling climate change.
Spot on, good timing. Jules.
Right. I'll pick up on what Rebecca's just said. It's touching on what you might call tribalism that's been going on in Parliament, and it's extremely sad because the problems that we're facing, and if you just mention one of the climate change and the need to move away from things like fossil fuels, it emphasises the fact that it has to be a cross-party collective, a meeting of minds through and through, not saying, oh, well, we'll do this, and then getting into power, and then the whip is saying, you can't go through that lobby, you've got to go through the other lobby. I, as an independent, don't have that. I'm completely unfettered in that sense. And I believe talking across, because most intelligent people will be prepared to listen. Maybe sometimes you agree not to agree, but there'll be times, greater times.
Okay.
I think it's very, very important that we put this tribalism away and start working towards sorting these problems out in the community, in the wide community, together.
Thank you. And finally, Simon, not leaving you out this time.
Hello. What could we do? There was more. That's quite a challenge because I think the Green Party manifesto is doing a hell of a lot. There's always going to be a balance between what's possible and what's desirable. We set 2030 as the target. I know Extinction Rebellion want a 2025 target. And as Julian kind of hints at, if technology comes along and improves and says that we can do it faster, let's do it faster. But we've got a plan at the moment that sets out how we can do it by then. But there's some really innovative ideas that we've got as well. Again, some picking up from other ideas, places like Extinction Rebellion. So we would bring in a Citizens Assembly, and that would be a really great way of pushing the government to do more, giving it some authority from outside of Parliament to say this is what the people want and act on that basis. It's a completely independent, unelected, randomly selected people. It's a really amazing idea and could really help. Another innovation that we've got is to replace the Chancellor with a carbon Chancellor sitting in number 11 Downing Street. So every decision in government comes through that office and is has to pass the test. Would it contribute to this goal or not?
And back to Jane just for one moment. Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs in between. Progress, no progress, yes, no?
I don't.
Very good. There we go. Honesty applies. Thank you for that, team, and thank you for sticking to the time. Second question, then, for this evening. This has come from St Albans Friends of the Earth, and the question is, what policies would your party implement to enable the planting of all the trees that you have promised? So what policies have your party, would your party implement to enable the planting of all the trees that they have promised? Julian.
Did you say policies?
That's what it says. Okay. To enable the planting of all the trees they have promised.
Thank you. So the Conservative Party manifesto is committing to deliver the Climate Change Committee number, 30,000 hectares per annum, scaled up over time. You will have heard the Labour offer of 2 billion, and I think there is an issue there. What is practical? What could be done? We've already seen on our own patch Hartwood Forest. A little bit further back, you've got the forest to the south, the Watling Chase Community Forest. So there is a lot, this area is doing a lot more than many parts of the country. You've got the Northern Forest, the Northumbrian Forest project at the moment, which is going on. There are specific, so rather than policy, I'm trying to answer it in terms of deliverable. We need to be able to deliver the trees in a practical manner, and that does require a proper detailed program. Rather than policy, I think it needs a proper project to deliver it.
A muted applause, but thank you for that. Daisy.
Well, as I said in my introduction, the Liberal Democrats are committed to planting 60 million trees a year. That's twice as many as the Conservatives have pledged to do. We need to do it in three ways. So first of all, we need to make sure that national parks have a much stronger responsibility for creating carbon sinks. Secondly, we need to create nature partnerships so that farms, local authorities and landowners can actually work together to identify the best places for those carbon sinks in the land. And we also, again, need to devolve powers down to local authorities so that they have both the responsibility, the powers and the funding to make sure that they're planting trees. Of course, when we talk about planting trees, these are trees that can be new woodland. They can be trees that are urban on our pavements and in our high streets, but it can also be on farms as well. And what's absolutely critical is that we plant the right trees in the right places. We know, for example, that if you plant trees in dry areas, then it soaks up carbon dioxide and methane. We know that if you plant them in wet areas, it can often have the opposite effect. Now, I visited a farm last week. Farmers are willing to do their bit, but we've got to create these nature partnerships so they can all work together.
Rebecca.
Thank you. So we've obviously made a commitment as the Labour Party to plant 2 billion trees by 2040. I know that's been much ridiculed, but actually it's not one person planting 2 billion trees, as I'm sure all of you are aware. But I think there are a number of things that we need to do, not just looking at how we plant those 2 billion trees, but also how we maintain our existing stock of trees. There's no point us planting 2 billion if we're going to continue to remove as many. So we're looking at creating 10 new national parks. We're looking at reviewing and improving our protected area designations, and we're looking at building 20,000 hectares of new English forest a year. And alongside that, we want to make sure that we've got local planting programs going on in all of our communities, because local authorities are doing such good work already on planting and protecting our tree stock.
And Jules.
Yeah, I think there needs to be a nationwide effort towards this, because there are some countries, we're fortunate here in the south, that we don't suffer the degrees of flooding that some places in the country do. And obviously it's evident that some of this is being caused by climate change. And they end up as the sort of second cousins thrice removed that aren't getting the support from the south. And yet, if we look back in history, the wealth education that was provided started in the north with the philanthropists that used to set up whole villages, and they had a church for their workers to go. They had somewhere to live. They were really looked after, and the wealth in this country predominantly was created in the north. Now, it doesn't mean to say that we don't have our problems down here in the south. And I mean, one of the things that we have, where you've got extremes of wet and dry times, it is the problems with pollution in our waterways and rivers, and that's something that mustn't be overlooked. It's all very well planting. We all understand about photosynthesis, but there are other. It's a total effort for all of these things being pulled together and like minded.
Thank you. We need to keep your points, Jules. And finally, Simon in this round.
Yeah, it's great. This is one of the examples of a policy that I'm delighted to hear. Everybody else is doing what we've always talked about doing. So we have 700 million trees in our manifesto. I can't remember if that's more or less than everyone else, but it's a lot of trees, and that's fantastic. But why do we want trees apart from the sort of visual amenity, as we call it in the council? No one else uses the word amenity, only councils. They're a really, really important way of soaking up carbon, of course. So as well as stopping producing carbon, you need to do things that soak up the carbon that you can't get rid of. Trees are a great way of doing that if you do it right. But actually, there's lots of other ways of doing that as well that we need to look at. And some of the things that are interesting in our manifesto, I think, are around farming. So as well as getting farmers to replant trees and hedgerows and so on, the way that you use the soil is a fantastic carbon sink if you use it right. So we've got policies looking at that. Rewilding in general, I know that the Wildlife Trust is really keen on this idea. It's saying, look, yes, tree planting is great and let's do it. But actually, rewilding, basically letting nature get on with it itself, is A, cheaper, and B, in many cases, more effective at soaking up carbon. So there's lots of great ideas out there, but I'm glad that everyone's keen on trees.
So there are any representatives from, well, there are clearly in St Albans Friends of the Earth. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Do we answer the question? Are we motivated? Do we feel happy? Yes, no? Got a thumbs up from the front, two thumbs up, three, four thumbs up. This is great. That's progress. Thank you, panel. Resounding success for that one. So question number three, we're starting to vary the order here. So you've had the sort of the nice introduction, the safe introduction. The cards are out. The timekeeper is active, Jules and team. And we're now getting down to the nitty-gritty. So question number three, and we're going to start with Simon on this, comes from Rachel Johnson on behalf of churches across the Diocese of St Albans. Thank you, Rachel, for this question. What is your party's position on providing financial support to householders to retrofit their homes to enable them to become carbon neutral? What's your party's position on providing financial support to householders to retrofit their homes to enable them to become carbon neutral? And because you spoke last time, I'm going to pick on you to start first.
Okay, thank you. Yes, great question, because of course this is the boring stuff in saving the planet, isn't it? Is things like retrofitting your housing. Housing is one of the top three sources of carbon emissions in the country and certainly in the developed world. So we definitely need to do something about it. And it's all very well, as we do and the other parties do as well, talk about building new houses and let's make them as efficient as possible. But actually new houses are only a tiny slice of the housing stock for the next 300 years probably. So we need to do something about the houses that we have, and retrofitting is the answer. Our policy is to retrofit 1 million houses a year. In a similar way, when we moved from to North Sea gas, every gas system in every house in the country was switched over to the new gas. We can go into every house and we can retrofit it. And we would do a really deep retrofit and spend billions on this, because that's money that pays back very, very quickly. Insulation is one of the quickest ways to get your money back, and also one of the most effective ways. It's also one of the most boring, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make it a priority.
Julian.
We too have a commitment to fund insulation for houses, but the focus of that money is on social housing and those living in poverty rather than the general public. And I think that is the right place to be. I'm quite disappointed how difficult it is, as I'm a councillor, as I said earlier, to try and get that into our social housing stock. And I would be quite keen to see some change in the approach to the legislation so that the social housing providers, who do provide a lead, funnily enough, to the private sector in this space, could be encouraged to do it by change of the legislation so that the people investing in that get the benefit of it, as well as the tenants. Having just been through my own retrofit in a 1920s house, I can see the value of it, but it is very expensive. So there is a cut-off between those who can afford it and those who can't. So I'm more than happy to support those at the bottom end and work our way up.
Daisy.
Where is Rachel? Who asked the question? Where's Rachel? Over there. Good. Okay. I'd like to address whoever it is. So it's our number one priority. It's our number one priority for the Liberal Democrats to make sure that every home is insulated by 2030, and that we start by making sure that everybody living in fuel poverty has their home insulated by 2025. When Liberal Democrats were in government, we did introduce the Green Deal, which was some funding that was available to support people wanting to insulate their home. Unfortunately, when the Conservatives were left to their own devices, they scrapped that. There are also, I think there's a role for government in innovating with energy companies. So if you go to Bristol, for example, there is a new scheme where Bristol Energy isn't charging people for the units of energy that they're using, but helping them with energy schemes for heating the home, room by room, temperature by temperature. And that's something that we really have to look at. The last thing is we are committed as part of our education programme to creating national colleges, sector by sector, that will look at issues like this. And I think there's really scope for improving innovation of insulating our homes in the decades to come.
It still comes back to this old chestnut of tribalism again. I know I keep mentioning it, but instead of thinking about ourselves, we have to think about other people. And if we sat down as sensible human beings, I, as an independent, would be very happy to work with any of the other parties. I'm not a party, I'm independent, but I'd be very happy to support sensible initiatives to deal with the issues that we've been discussing this evening. I wouldn't have any problem with that, and I don't have a party pulling my ear. So it's a collective thing. We all have to do something together to do it, and it's almost like saying, okay, well, I'll put my red flag down, I'll put my yellow flag down, I'll put my blue flag down. Let's have a meeting of minds. It's so important.
Good. Well done. Rachel, did we answer the question? Oh, sorry, forgive me, Rebecca. Rebecca.
Thank you. I want to pick up on a couple of things that my colleagues up here have said. I don't think that we've done anywhere near enough to... Daisy talked about the Green Deal. I actually worked with an insulation provider during that period of time, and we went into government on multiple opportunities, and nobody took any notice of anything that we would say. And picking up on Julian's point, within the council in Southwark,
just making sure we get the audio on that. So going back to Rachel this time, sorry I got in there early. Did we answer the question? Yes, no, thumbs up, thumbs down? So. We've got some thumbs ups at the back, but certainly in between for Rachel. Thank you for that question. So question number four, one that I probably could have put money on would turn up tonight, is a question around Luton Airport. So what is your position? It's unattributed as well. So no, actually there's no name to this, so I'm sure it's on many people's minds. What is your position on the proposed Luton Airport extension and its impact on the local communities, including traffic, noise, pollution, etc.? So what is the position regarding Luton Airport extension and its impact to the local communities? Daisy.
I am wholly opposed to it, and so are the Liberal Democrats. Since 2015, the passenger numbers at Luton Airport have grown from 9 million passengers per year to 18 million passengers per year. It's doubled already. Their application for expansion would lead to there being 34 million passengers per year. And that's because that's the maximum they're allowed to expand to at the moment. But they're very clear that their ultimate ambition is to go even further, up to between 36 or 38 million passengers per year. Now, I went to the Luton consultation the other day at Catherine Street, and I know a number of you were there protesting outside. But their plans were awful. Now, when I said to them, "Where in your consultation document, there isn't actually an option to say I'm wholly opposed to this." And they said, well, that's because the Conservative government have a policy of expansion. And therefore, if you want to change that policy, you have to change the government. So I'm afraid I'm wholly opposed to Luton Airport expansion, and we can't stop it unless we can stop the Conservatives.
Jules.
Luton Airport. It's been creepingly growing and growing and growing. And a lot of that is driven by the demand that's made for air travel. And the offers, particularly the very low offers that companies like Ryanair and EasyJet have been pushing under people's noses, and it makes it very easy for them to travel. Now, I enjoy flying. I went to the States and learned to fly, so it's a discipline that I love. I love flying, but also, as an inventor, I cannot stop thinking about ways to reduce the pollution that aircraft cause. And cars, anything that has some, if it's jet propulsion or it's an internal combustion engine, typical that we use daily.
Final comment.
We've all got to work together to reduce this, all of us. Everybody in this room, every politician, up and down the country.
Got it, Jules, well done. Rebecca.
Thank you, and hopefully this might work better. Great. So I am completely opposed to any expansion of Luton Airport, and I think the Labour manifesto has been quite clear about how we will assess any future expansion to airports. We have a series of tests that we would like any airport expansion to pass. So looking at air quality, noise pollution, our climate change obligations, and actually what the benefits are to the countryside as well. And I don't think that the expansion of Luton Airport fulfills any of those obligations. Instead, we'd be looking to invest in rail. So we'd be looking to carry HS2 all the way up to Scotland. We'd be looking at having Crossrail for the north, and we'd be investing in cycling and walking and providing those other opportunities for people to be able to get around. That means that they don't need to fly in the first place.
Simon.
I am completely against the expansion of Luton Airport. I'm completely against the expansion of all airports. As we know, air travel is the fastest growing source of emissions in the transport sector. So we need a frequent flyer tax so that everybody can have a flight a year, no problem at all. But those 15% of people who take 70% of the flights in this country, we need to rein that in a little bit, frankly, and reduce that freedom a little bit, and you do that through the tax system. When I challenged an executive of Luton Airport to say what he was doing about environmental concerns, he said, "We're putting in low flush toilets in the airport," which gives you a sense of the challenge here. This is why we need government action. Those guys are not going to do it by themselves if that's what they think we're talking about. So yes, we need to tax people out of the air to a certain extent. We also need to, of course, have the carrot of much, much better public transport, expanding public transport hugely, using money from HS2, frankly, to create a proper electrified modern rail network.
Finally, Julian.
I already explained in my opening words Anne's position on the expansion that she's been campaigning for many years to constrain it and oppose it. There's a particular concern here because it's owned by a local authority, and they're giving, more often than not, they've been giving themselves permission to expand it, and they have a tremendous financial need driver for that. I recognise the importance, having said that, of Luton Airport to the local economy, particularly for those who live in Luton and Bedfordshire beyond. But there is a balance in all these things, and the expansion, certainly the way they're putting it forward, is not acceptable. Rather like the comments from our Labour candidate here, there are a number of criteria which I think need to be addressed. I recognise that over time, innovation and technology has improved what goes on in flights. I just wanted to take a little question on the Lib Dem position. While they're clearly against Heathrow Airport, their manifesto has a different stance on regional airports like Luton.
Good. Just waiting for that one. So ask the audience time, because there was no one attributed to that. So in general, this is your chance now, audience, for all of you. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Have we got a position, clear view? What's your view on the debate and your feeling on the expansion of Luton Airport? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Up. Generally speaking, people undecided or definitely down. A couple of people expressing a view. Okay, it's a difficult one. You've heard a range of views on that. Just a moment just to remind you that we have our social media hashtag for today, hashtag EnviroHust19. So if you are following or wishing to contribute on that, don't forget to use that later on or during the course of tonight's proceedings. So question number five, John Pritchard, where are you? John, would you like to ask your question?
Can you hear me? John Pritchard. The River Ver ran dry and Verulamium Lake was in a terrible state again this summer. Do you agree that the new government should be funding a major advertising campaign to encourage us all to use less water and leave more for the environment?
I should say, John, you represent the Ver Valley Society as well, is that correct?
I do.
You do. Very good. Should we be doing more to make awareness around sustainability of water in our rivers and in general? So I'll start with Rebecca.
Thank you. And yes, I think we should. I was listening yesterday to a podcast by James Ashton, where he was interviewing the chief executive at Anglia Water, who was talking about their Love Every Drop campaign. And I think it's incredibly important that we reduce the amount of water that we're using in everyday life. I think initiatives like the showerheads that are given away quite often at local events that I go to that restrict the amount of water coming out are incredibly useful, as well as thinking about things like water storage in your own garden. That means that you have a better source of water to be able to use when the weather does not necessarily provide the water that we need. I think we've seen the huge impact that floods have in this country, and we need to think much better about the ways in which we are storing water and using it for those periods when there is a drought, and we need to think carefully about the ways in which we can be saving water going forward.
Thank you, Rebecca. Simon.
Be a grand idea. However, there's a danger in focusing too much on personal activity. Personal activity is important, but the scale of the problem that we're facing, both in water usage in this country and particularly in our region, and in climate change more widely, the scale of the problem means that we need large-scale system change, not just personal change. So yes, everyone should be using less water, and an ad campaign would help. But the water companies need to be out fixing the leaks, they need to be building reservoirs, and they need to be moving water through pipes from one part of the country to the other, like they do in other parts of the world, in order to get the water where it's needed. And all new homes need to be built to the highest possible standards. Again, you make it easy for people by doing it the natural thing. The default option is then you use a water company that doesn't use much water. You buy a house that doesn't use much water, that recycles the rainwater off the roof to go through your toilet instead of using fresh water for toilets. That's how you solve this problem on a larger scale, not by individual actions, not alone anyway.
Julian.
To your question, John, yes, we should all do our bit. I think metering is helping change people's behaviour, and the more that is rolled out, the better. I believe that it's not just about us, though I do think business and agriculture have a big role to play. How they use water, so I guess I'm echoing a little bit Simon's comments. And so much so do I believe in this that I have the job I have now because my uncle was pushing that message 25 years ago, and my son is doing a PhD in that very subject.
Thank you. Daisy.
Thank you. Well, John, I was really pleased to come on the River Ver protest with hundreds of people that were mobilised in the space of, I think, about 36 hours. There are two problems. One is over-extraction by Affinity Water and other private companies, and the other is the change in the climate, because we used to be a wet county and now we're a really dry county, and those are two problems that compound each other. Now, the Liberal Democrats, who are now running the local council, have taken on an advocacy role. They have contacted Affinity Water, but they have no statutory responsibility to do that. The buck stops with the Environment Agency, and the buck stops with the Secretary of State, and there simply hasn't been enough action. There simply hasn't been enough enforcement. It is an absolute scandal. an absolute scandal that fish were dying on the dry banks of the Ver when people were using water to water their gardens. There should have been action to put a hosepipe ban in. If not this year, then last year or the year before. We need a proper enforcement body that's actually going to take action and protect our chalk streams now and for future generations.
And finally, Jules.
There's a distinct lack of policing by the environmental agencies to actually monitor what is going on. I mean, for example, in the countryside, people that live and are born in the countryside understand how to conserve water. They'd probably have several water butts around their property. They use it for watering the garden. They can recycle it. And they're not drawing on the main fresh water supplies, which sadly is leaking at a disproportionate rate around the country. And I agree with what's been said about the it seems difficult to monitor this loss of water, and they're not bothering maybe for 24 hours. And I've seen this on along Hatfield Road when nobody's come out to actually stem the flow. So how many hundreds of thousands of gallons, or maybe more, have been lost of fresh water that's cost us a lot to...
We've got it, Jules, thank you. Time's up for you, I'm afraid. Appreciate that we've come off that particular question. Did we answer, John? Did you get a decent answer there from the panel, from the group? Did you feel that you had? Good. There you go. There's a good thumbs up for all of the team. So thank you, panel. This next question I'll read out is relating to businesses and how businesses need some support. So panel, what will you be doing to encourage and support local businesses to become more sustainable and reduce business footprint? We do have a name. Helen, would you like to identify yourself? You don't have to, because you didn't put your surname on there. Helen, thank you. Just in the second row there. Bless you for doing that. Thank you. So the question again, what will you be doing to encourage and support local businesses to become more sustainable and reduce their footprint? Simon.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important that you have policies that are fairly subtle around the area of business, because businesses... if you take them all together, you can argue are a huge source of problems in this country in terms of the emissions that are produced and the effect on climate change, and that, you know, they're run for profit, so they have to balance these things. Why should they reduce their emissions? And so you clobber them with massive taxes, and indeed we would be putting up corporate tax. But then you go to the small high street shops that we love, or the independent shops, and it's a totally different ballgame. And yet these people are being clobbered by the same rules. So, you know, business rates, for example, is a classic case. Huge problem in St Albans for our pubs in particular and others. The same system is being used to try and get some tax out of these people as is being used against the huge corporate. So we have to change that completely. We would completely change the tax system in this country. And for businesses, that would mean abolishing rates completely and having a land value tax, so it's the landlord that pays the tax. I've run out of time, but you get the idea.
Rebecca.
So I think there are two things that we need to be doing. I think we first need to look at, before we build any buildings, how we make sure that we are building them in the most sustainable way, so that businesses that are moving into those buildings are not being left with buildings that are not insulated and are going to have much higher bills than everybody else. And part of that is looking at the planning processes and the way in which we can do that. The second of those is around bringing our water and our energy into democratic ownership, which will obviously help us to see that bills are reducing across the board. I'm going to stop there. I feel like my minute was quite curtailed somewhat there.
You did well. You got through the technical bit. Well done. Jules, also in just a minute, I'll invite you to comment. Jules.
A lot of it's about education. There aren't any evident task force skilled enough to actually go around and talk to all the companies, because people at home may well find ways to reduce the use of the water that they have. But in companies, when they go to work, they're not encouraged. So the use of the water could be triple that of they would normally for the hours they may spend at work. And that there should be teams of people going around to talk about the environment and talk about the need to conserve everything we have, because water is a precious commodity. I mean, without it, we cannot survive. And that's just one thing alone, apart from the poisonous emissions that are generated from companies that have to power the machines to produce things. It's about education.
Thank you. Daisy.
So Helen, there's a few things we can do. The first has got to be reform of business rates. It's an outdated system that is crippling our high street, and it is linked to the climate disaster. The way business rates are calculated, it looks at the value of the land, the value of the property, and the value of the property use. If you put solar panels on a local business, it increases the value of the property and your business rate tax goes up. So if you actually change the business rate system, as we're proposing, to tax just the value of the land, you isolate the value of the land and you incentivise, or you take off the cap of the system that is capping the incentive for local businesses to actually green their businesses, whether that's through services or through improvements to the building. That's the first thing we need to do, is reform the business rate system and allow local businesses to do what they're trying to do without getting penalised. The second is setting up the Green Investment Bank. We set one up when we were in coalition. I'm afraid the Tories shut it down again, but we set up a new one that would bring new green finance forward, so that local businesses could actually borrow money for green improvements at a better rate. And the third thing is the workforce. We are a really competitive country at the moment, but if we can stop Brexit, we can keep getting the best talent from across Europe to come and work for our small businesses, whatever they might do.
Thank you, Daisy. And Julian, finally.
So in my experience, local businesses of all sorts do take this issue seriously and are trying their best to address it. So I take the, you've got me thinking, and I shall have to go away and take some of that thinking elsewhere with my council hat on. But I think there is educational requirements. So there are things that local government particularly know, which they can share with local businesses and should. So I think there's a leadership role for local government here. I am disappointed that, notwithstanding the fact there was an all-party support for the climate emergency back in July, which Daisy has mentioned, very little has actually happened since, notwithstanding the fact it's an emergency. So this would be one of the practical things that the council could do. And there's folk over there, the Sustainable St Albans counter. I think much of what they're doing I'm more than happy to support, and I think that is useful information for local businesses.
So Helen, you know I'm going to come to you. Thumbs up, thumbs down, did the thing. Thumbs up. Well done, panel. You've got a definite thumbs up there. You're friends of Helen tonight. Next question. We're dead on 9 o'clock, so well done, timekeeper. Thank you, Ed, down there. Again, from Rachel Johnson. Rachel, just remind me where you are. Just at the back there. Very different question. This is on education and youth, and again, you represent St Albans Diocese and on behalf of all the churches across Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire, so thank you again for this question. Children around the country are going on strike for climate. You've seen the news and you've heard the stories in the press. How would you listen to and take account of the concerns and ideas of young people? So children on strike for climate, how would you take and listen to the accounts and concerns and ideas of young people? I'm going to start with Daisy.
Okay, so a few things. First of all, I already am. I know a number of the small school children who have been on strike, and I think it's brilliant that so many of our local head teachers have been supporting the children wanting to do that. Just a few days ago, I joined the march in the middle of our city, organised by the Student Youth Network, and spoke to them, but also listened to them as well. The clearest way, I'm afraid, that we can actually listen to young people is actually to allow them to vote. You know what? We've got 10 years to act. We've got 10 years to stop irreversible damage to the planet. And anybody who is under the age of 18 by next Thursday doesn't have a say. There's potentially only two general elections between now, hopefully only two, but there might be more, two elections between now and irreversible damage to the planet. We must give young people the vote so they can vote on their future and vote in the ballot box. It's the single most important thing we can do. Rather than just listening, allow them to speak themselves.
Julian.
Thank you. I think we do need to listen. Politicians do need to listen. And I think a big part of the success of the climate movement of late has been because young people have got behind it. With respect, the organisations that have been around for a long time, even Simon's organisation, have been working hard, and it's suddenly got an impetus, mainly, I think, because of the young folk and because of the Extinction Rebellion events in the last 12 months in particular. I was trying to bring it back to my own household, and I mentioned before my son's doing a PhD, so how we use water in our household has changed dramatically. And the fact that I mentioned earlier also that we've gone and re-insulated and our retrofitted our 1920s house, and that's come from my children saying that's what we should do. And I think we need to do that on a bigger scale, but I think it is happening on a bigger scale, as you can hear from the answers you've had earlier this evening.
Simon.
Yes, our party policy is to lower the voting age to 16, to include 16 and 17 year olds in all elections in this country, in all referenda. That would have been a good idea. I do think that it's very sad and very poignant, really, that the two big issues that we've got at this election and over the last couple of years, Brexit and climate change, young people feel totally, literally disenfranchised, because they are, but they have this feeling of what can I do? And so many parents will know that their children's kind of emotional reaction to these both of those issues actually leads to a sense of frustration, because they feel there's nothing they can do about it. And that has been, it's been great that people like XR have taken that up and given young people an opportunity to do something with, to literally do something, because it's not only a good idea to do something because it gets things done, but also psychologically for young people, it's really important that they feel they are able to be part of the change. So giving them the vote would be a really important part of that.
Thank you, Simon. Rebecca.
So I agree with both of my colleagues here that we obviously need to lower the voting age to include 16 and 17 year olds, but actually I think that's still disenfranchising a huge part of our community who have such an interest and such a passion for making sure that we're tackling climate change, because it's about their future. So we too, like Simon, are committing to a citizens' assembly, and rather than that just being people who are able to vote, I want to make sure that we've got children represented on that citizens' assembly to ensure that we are really listening to their views and their concerns and also their ideas, because they're full of them. They're out on the streets protesting and coming up with some brilliant ways that we should be tackling these problems. And I'd want to go into local schools and make sure that we're having climate committees across the constituency that are continually innovating and bringing up new ideas and making sure that politicians are taking them seriously.
Jules.
What we need to accept is that the youngsters will be taking our place on this planet. And every derelict step that we take will cause problems for their future. We need to think about them, and the exciting thing is that the youngsters want to get involved, but it can be done in an orderly fashion, but they need to feel that they're being listened to. And I get the feeling that sometimes by certain sections parties and government seem to be very dismissive of them, and I don't think that's right. I think they need to be treated as intelligent adults that are most likely be going on to university. They care about this country too.
suggested 17.
We only have the minute, but thank you for that point. He's entitled to change his mind, as has anybody in life. We can move from there. Thank you for that. Just a question for the audience before we go back to ask Rachel about how well the panel done. How many of you, hands up, have taken part in a strike recently, who have gone on to join any of the marches as well? So there's a reasonable proportion of you there, young and old. Very, very vigorous from Mimi on here on the left. And Rachel, and your role as Dyson Environment Officer, how did the panel do in terms of answering your question? Thumbs up. Panel, you're doing well. This is amazing. Good stuff. Okay, so we're smack on time, so you'll be out here on time. Colin Hodges, where are you? Colin, would you like to read out your question?
It's quite a long question. Climate change poses complex questions which our current five-year electoral politics has shown itself unable to address. Extinction Rebellion demand that government create and be led by the decisions of a citizens' assembly on climate and ecological justice. Please would the candidates state to what extent they support and will seek to implement this demand.
Right. Rebecca, we're going to get you a microphone. I shouldn't have asked for you first, should I? Because you.
Thank you very much. So I think I pretty much answered that in my last question with our commitment to a citizens' assembly. And actually, I'd like to see it widened to make sure that we're bringing young people into that citizens' assembly as well, to make sure that we are truly listening to all of their views. And I think I mentioned it in one of my other previous answers as well. I'd be really keen to make sure that we're working cross-party. I think, you know, everyone has made such great efforts in their manifesto to commit to so many policies that are about tackling climate change. And actually, we need to make sure that we're taking the best of all three of those manifestos and bringing them together so that we can truly tackle this problem sensibly over the next few years.
Jules.
As I said earlier, I think we need to involve the youngsters more, and we need to encourage them to not only question as they do, but even provide from their knowledge possible solutions to some of these problems that we are facing. And if they seem more than keen to do that, I think that should be encouraged, but just not on a small basis. It should be across the country. And again, that's down to people talking to people, and also to funding, because I appreciate the fact that the lack of funding for setting up certain initiatives can rather hamper the progress of these things.
Daisy.
Yes, Liberal Democrats are completely committed to having a citizens' assembly, like some others up here as well. And we'd be happy to have local ones as well. Why not have them at a local authority level as well as at the national level? I think the conventional thinking is interesting. The conventional thinking is that you need a citizens' assembly because we're going to have to make such enormous changes, the public are going to be resistant. And actually, I think on some areas, it's going to be that people are going to be demanding more than decision makers can actually deliver. So I think it's important for two reasons. I've actually been to see a citizens' assembly. I went to Manchester last year and watched one. It was on an NHS issue, but I watched how it worked. I got a takeaway booklet about the way that they'd prepared the questions, the way they'd selected the people, the way that they'd brought professionals in, the way that they had cross-examination of different expert witnesses. And it was actually to watch a really fascinating and brilliant, brilliant process to watch. So I'm all in favour of it. One other small part of your question was around democracy and the five-year short-termism. I think we've got a lot of problems with our democracy, which are leading to the climate disaster. First past the post encourages competition, not collaboration. We're the most centralised country in Europe. We need to decentralise, we need to have proportional representation, and we need to start building consensus on how we tackle this in this enormous emergency.
Daisy. Julian.
I agree it's a complex question. I'm not convinced that a citizens' assembly is the right idea to solve it. I was thinking earlier how the British political system creates confrontation on this sort of subject where that's not what we need. We need cooperation, as Jules has been saying several times, because he has the benefit of not being within those constructions. But I am concerned that a large proportion of the population, particularly those who are not affluent, are disengaged from what we're talking about in this room. So we do need something which helps to engage that element of the population and take them with us. We can see it on our own efforts when we're trying to get the recycling rates up in St Albans. And I've championed locally the involvement of community groups in how the council approaches the work that we do following the climate emergency declaration we made in July. And it's interesting that at a local level that was pushed back against but accepted at the council. We need to do more of that, drawing on the skills and knowledge of our local residents and across the country.
Thank you, Julian. Simon.
Yes, I think the Citizens' Assembly model is a really interesting one. We definitely need proportional representation. Our first-past-the-post system is completely broken. I talked about disenfranchisement earlier, and a lot of people feel disenfranchised one way or another. There's been a lot of talk in this constituency about tactical voting, which is an outrage that in a modern democracy we're having to consider voting tactically. But there we are. A Citizens' Assembly, very useful. These ideas of sort of direct democracy can really help, I think, to rebalance faith in our democracy. I think it's also important to say that the government should have to act on, and not just listen to, but actually act on the decisions of that assembly. Very much like a jury system, people who are nervous about this, that's how our judicial system works. A jury of ordinary people get selected at random to go and decide very, very important things. It's the same principle as that. And it works in the same way, so there's nothing to be scared of. It's set up properly, orchestrated properly. It will be a hugely valuable thing for us, I think.
Thank you, Simon. Colin, did the panel achieve their objective? You're being kind. So we're not quite there, but three good. Colin, thank you. Well, at least we met some of your expectations. Thank you for that. So the next question is from Peter Kayser. If I got that right, Peter, thank you. You've asked me to read this out, so I hope you don't mind. So panel, the question is, the world needs a deal to leave fossil fuels in the ground. How will you make sure the UK government leads the way in bringing about this agreement? So fossil fuels in the ground, how are we going to ensure the government does what it said it's going to do? Julian, let's start with you.
So I think that's coming, and the question is the pace at which it comes. I was heartened, as I imagine some people in the audience were as well, to see back in the summer, in June, National Power announcing that zero carbon energy sources were over those coming from fossil fuel. I think it's coming. I mentioned earlier the importance of innovation. So for non-fossil fuels to work, we need to have the ability to store electricity in particular in batteries. And that's where I think R&D effort needs to go. And the sooner that's sorted, the quicker we'll be able to come off fossil fuels and the carbon that creates.
Thank you. Simon.
Do two things here, haven't you? We've got to get rid of fossil fuels as soon as possible, and of course you provide the replacement, of course. So how do you do the former? Well, first of all, you take away the subsidies. It's a massively oversubsidized industry. Offshore wind is already more efficient than oil, even with the subsidies. So if you take those away, that's one thing you can do. Introduce a carbon tax, so it's more expensive to use fossil fuels directly and indirectly. That will help. Tax system is a wonderful thing. Let's use it to tax bad things rather than tax good things. Julian mentioned technology. That's absolutely right. I don't know if you heard Lord Stern was on the radio this morning who produced a report in 2006, and they said to him, you know, all these years later, are you more worried now than you were then? He said, well, yes, in some ways, but the technology is now there. It's all there, ready to do this stuff. We already have within our reach 70% wind power in this country. It's quite easy to do. It just takes the easiest part of the jigsaw to fix, actually, because we're much of the way there already.
Rebecca.
So I think it's very much about finding the alternatives and putting them into practice. So as the Labour Party, we've committed to 7,000 offshore and 2,000 onshore wind turbines. We've committed to enough solar panels to cover 22,000 football pitches. We're investing £2 billion in joint ventures to develop tidal lagoon and tidal stream technologies. And then we're looking at how we can help local communities. So having better investment in things like district heating networks, which now many of them are at their end of life and need replacing and improving to make sure that we are using the right types of energy there. But we're also going to immediately and permanently ban fracking. And then we also need to work together on a global scale. But it's not just about us doing something, it's also about everyone working together. And we need to make sure that we're working on a global scale to ensure that we can diversify the types of energy that we're using.
Thank you. Jules, in just a minute.
Sorry, you mean just in, I thought you wanted to make a week. Okay, just in a minute, 1 minute. Okay. I keep beating this drum about hydrogen, and nobody's picking up the baton on this. It can't be avoided because we are in an increasing crisis situation. We may not be feeling the full effects at the moment of these poisonous emissions. But I believe within 10 years it'll become much more apparent. So I agree with all of my colleagues on the panel here. It needs to be a collective effort. It does need to be a collective effort, and we have to put this tribalism. And I've used it again, but you know what I mean. It has to be. If it comes from the heart, we'll do it, and other people will see it. The youngsters will see it, and they'll be right behind those that are taking initiatives, and it may well be the youngsters are taking the initiative too.
Thank you. And Daisy.
Thank you. I think somebody shouted out that the Lib Dems had received some money from a fracking company. Just in case anybody is still in any doubt about that, that was a personal donation made by a member of the Lib Dems to Joe Swinson. It came from a company that produces 80%. I'm happy to answer your question, sir. I've even repeated your question so everyone can understand what I'm trying to answer. So the allegation, and I hope the chair will allow me some more time, the allegation is that the Liberal Democrats received £14,000 from a fracking company for Joe Swinson's campaign. The reality is that that claim has been challenged in a court of law and found to be false and libelous. The donation was made in an individual capacity. It was made from the director of a company which happens to produce 80% renewable energy and holds two fracking licences, but neither of those fracking licences had been used. So that's my rebuttal to that particular intervention, if that's allowed. Could I now answer the question? Thank you. In answer to the question, in order to answer the question, what do we need to do to tackle fossil fuels? One, we need to stop fracking. So I have to say that. I've never been supported fracking. Joe Swinson and every other Liberal Democrat has said that we are against fracking. Secondly, we do need to increase subsidies for renewables. Three, we need a green investment bank so we attract private money to actually help in the development of new energy sectors where there are slightly more high risk. Four, we need to use our international influence. If we can stop Brexit, we can use our influence in the EU to make every EU country adopt a net zero policy, and our influence in trade deals to make sure that we have really strong green goals in all our international trade deals.
So we've got some answers to at least one question off the floor. Appreciate that. With respect to the panel, everyone has their point of view, and I understand the passion in that debate. Peter, if I may, though, how did the panel do in your opinion in terms of delivering an answer to that? You've got a Romanesque, not sure panel. So there's obviously room for improvement there from our overall panelists. Just coming down to the last two questions. And thank you, audience, for maintaining your decorum and keeping it going. We are in St Albans after all. Food security is the next area. And Kate, where are you? Kate Swindles. Kate, hello, thank you. Do you mind if I read your question for you? Thank you. The thoughts really, panel, around grain harvest, for instance. Since we import a lot of our food, what could you do to ensure the nation and locally in St Albans is prepared as much as possible for the increasingly unpredictable and severe climate conditions that threaten global food production and thus the UK's food security? So particularly on grain seems to be the focus on this. So what are we going to do to manage local environment to be prepared increasingly for severe climate and how that will affect our food security? Jewel.
Okay, as in now, yeah, okay. Well, this is about housekeeping. We have to assess what the needs and the growing needs on a graduated scale. And as the needs increase, then we need to meet that increase. And that means talking to our European partners and any others. As long as it has integrity, then there's no problem, because we don't have the landmass to produce in the same way that Australia does.
And thank you. That's great. Daisy.
So a few things. To be honest, I don't think we've actually got all the answers to this. So I think hopefully some new solutions might appear. But we need a national food strategy, that's for sure. A national food strategy would look at making sure that our food is healthy as well as sustainable. And also that would tackle food waste. Our farmers are absolutely critical to this. Now, I've spoken to the NFU 3 or 4 times locally. I've visited 2 or 3 different farms. The NFU farmers are a really key role, but the only regulator that exists for farmers is quite punitive and occasionally slaps fines on them. It doesn't do anything to give them advice on how to balance both food and grain and protecting the soil and all those kind of things. So there's definitely a role there to improve that. We need to massively, massively reduce our meat consumption. I don't think we need to ban it, but we have got to massively, massively reduce our meat consumption. And I do think that we could become world producers of meat supplements, so in the alternative to meat. The last thing I would say, there is a little bit of innovation going on at the moment. I don't know if you know, but up in the north of the country, there are some people looking at building farms underground to protect it from extreme weather conditions, and that's the kind of innovation that we're going to need. So we need to invest in R&D in the future of our food security.
Julian.
I mentioned earlier that on our own doorstep we have Rothamsted Research, who specialise in grain. So the topics that you're talking about are very much on their agenda. And if I could give a little plug to anyone in the audience who's got any bright ideas on it, they are running a £3 million fund called Shake Climate Change, which is being funded by a foundation, but is looking to find the answers to that sort of question. So have we got any, I would say, young folk or even old folk who've got some solutions, please put your hat in the ring for some of that funding. And that's looking at other things as well, how we use water, how intensive we use water. Simon's point about using soil to capture carbon, that's a project they've got on the go. Replacing plastic with starch-based products. I've seen one of the innovation companies there producing it, which you can print on and is as tough as plastic. So on our doorstep, we've got it and we should make more of it.
Thank you. So I want to start by actually saying that I think it's a travesty that so many people in this country are going hungry. And actually, we need to factor in the use of food banks into any future food strategy that we have in this country. But I think there are a number of things that we should and could be doing. The first of those is that we've made a commitment to have a net zero carbon food production by 2040. We're going to set up a National Food Commission to review the whole of our food system. And we also want to look at reviewing the Allotments Act. This is something that we're already doing in Southwark, not reviewing the Act, but looking at our use of allotments. And actually, local growing is so important. It helps bring communities together, but it's also producing food and making a good contribution to the constituency. I think it's something that we should be doing throughout the whole of the country, not just in local pockets across the country as we currently are.
This is this is a really interesting question again, sort of the unsexy end of climate change. Yeah, this is incredibly important. It's the food that we eat, and actually when people say, well, what's if we do nothing, what's going to be one of the problems that we're faced with? It's going to be food scarcity throughout the world, but also here as well, and we're hugely reliant on food imports, of course. So one of the areas to look at is reforming the common agricultural policy, of course. Can't believe we're still saying that after all these years, but it needs to be done, and you can't do that if you leave the European Union, so let's stay in there. Another area is changing the whole model of farming here, which is partly due to the cap at common agricultural policy, but for other reasons as well. We have an agribusiness system here, which is not set up to produce food in the most sustainable way, certainly not organic. Organic food is more expensive because it's not supported by the appropriate subsidies. So let's change that system to make our use of land much more orientated towards food. And the other area has been touched on is that let's use less of our land for producing food for animals and more for producing food for people, because it's a much more sustainable way of using our land.
Thank you, panel. And we, before we ask Kate her view, we're just coming down onto the last question. So, Kate, how did? Kayser, where are you, Peter? There you go. Thank you again for this one. This is a personal question. A really intelligent question as well. Thank you, Peter. Really love this one. So, panel, the question is, the public are no longer asking if there is a climate crisis, but how to respond. What's been your personal response so far as an individual, and what would you be doing to help your constituents respond? So we're no longer asking if there's a climate crisis, but they're asking now how to respond. What's your personal journey, and how will you be doing and supporting your constituents in that? Can I start with Jules this time?
You need to be providing, if there's going to be a collective effort, we all need to be provided with a graph that shows the effects that we're suffering, and any particular increase in carbon fossil fuels and the like, and see how it actually is impacting. So it's almost a bit like a barometer, and that. And we need to look at that from not only our perspective, but other countries too. And we need to be looking at each other to see, okay, we need to match that.
Rebecca.
So on a very personal level, I am very committed to my recycling and my food waste collection, and I've reduced my meat consumption as well. But I think more importantly is the role that I hold on the council, and I mentioned it back at the very beginning. So within my cabinet member portfolio, I'm responsible for both parks and for trees, two things that are both really, really important to help us tackle climate change. And I'm not going to stop promoting how important both of those things are, making sure that we are continuing to plant more and more trees in our borough and looking after the ones that we have, and promoting the vital benefits that parks and green spaces provide, not only for health reasons, but also for environmental reasons.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's not much. It's not long for this, but how can you help? How can one help constituents? I mean, this touches on so many areas of life, education, health policy, mental health policy, the jobs of the future. All these things are connected with how we respond to climate change as a community. And I would hope to be able to put policies in place that would help constituents to deal with that. My personal journey, I got into politics, as I said, because of this 30 years ago. I've been trying to do something about climate change. Personally, I don't eat meat. I've got a hybrid car. I walk and get the train most of the time. But I don't want to. I think it's really dangerous to focus too much, as I said, on personal responsibility, because it's much, much bigger and more urgent than that. We need a total transformation of our society and our economy. You and I cannot go out and build wind farms. We cannot go out and double the capacity of the national grid, which is what we need to do. Okay, that is a job for government. So we need to use our votes to tell the government that's what we expect them to do.
At the personal level, I think I try to lead by example. I cycle pretty much everywhere. It was a really pleasant surprise this evening to have trouble finding anywhere to put my bicycle. And those who came later will know what I'm talking about. So for constituents, what a high priority for me would be to try and persuade more money to go into paying better cycle parking spaces. I have great pride, in fact, in the fact that St Albans Station is one of the best served parking spaces for bicycles in the country outside central London. It's an education issue. It has more parking spaces for cycles than most. Coming back to the question on the constituents level, it is about education and trying to provide practical ways for the population at large, as well as yourselves, who will be particularly motivated by this, to do their bit. And we use the example locally. There's still a lot more we could do on our waste recycling, and I think we should and should continue to try to do so.
So there's a few things. First, I would lead by example as well. In the last year or so, I took this 25 steps to become a climate hero from the Sustainable St Albans Festival, and me and my husband have done 15 of them. We're still working our way through them. The second is I would continue to show my support for community initiatives. I've already helped to collect petition signatures for the Climate Emergency Declaration. I protested with other people for the VER and organised sessions as part of the Sustainable St Albans Festival. The third thing I would try to do is empathise and show you how much I share your frustration. I remember being a little girl, and at the age of 8, I was planting conkers and trying to flog trees to holidaymakers from London, telling them if they didn't buy the trees, the planet was going to die. My mum had me dressed up in an acid rain t-shirt at the age of 8 or 9. That was 30 years ago. That was 30 years ago, and we're still not acting. The very last thing I would say, and I'm sorry if this brings things down a little bit, I've been quite smiley throughout this campaign, but if I'm honest with you, I've had some really somber moments at home, because I've been speaking to some very young people from the age of 11, and when you add up Brexit and the climate emergency and knife crime and all these other issues, I tell you what, I've had my moments where I've really wondered what kind of world are we leaving for our young people? And if you elect me next week as your MP, I will carry that with me every single day.
Peter, did we get a thumbs up there? We got a thumbs up. Thank you. Panel, you outsold yourself at the end there. So thank you. It just after 9:30, so I just want to... easing it, making sure I don't slip up, although I did. Ed, for keeping time. Ed, thank you for doing that and making sure people did stop. Well done for listening to it. Mimi, for being amazing with the mic. Hear us. Those four, thank you very much for making tonight happen. So that brings us to the hustings. Will be available on Radio Verulam website as a podcast. An unedited video will be posted on YouTube. And most importantly, my thanks and your thanks to Daisy Cooper, Simon Grover, Rebecca Lurie, and Julian and Jules Sherrington. Thank you.